join me all on stage. You have to stay as well. So, thank you. Okay, so if learning is about being interesting into something, I think we share it. But what struck me was that I found out about a lot of things I didn't even know that I didn't found out. Namely networks in all their complexity, although I was suspicious in a way. So now is your time. Raise your hands. You may also ask in German, in case you want to speak German. Please wait for the mic, because if not, we can't translate. There is a question over there, in the middle. Maybe, vielleicht können Sie das Mikrofon einfach weitergeben, in die Mitte reichen. And it would be great if we could have a little more light on the floor so that we can see who is talking. Please.
I can also get up. Hi, I have a question for Katie. Actually, I have a lot of questions for Katie because I've been following the Quest to Learn for a long time. It's really exciting, very, very cool project. And I guess my one question is, are you planning on scaling it, growing it, opening more schools, or sharing your curriculum? Yeah, that's my question.
So there is not a plan to scale necessarily, but what the Institute of Play has done is, if you go to the website, there's tons of downloadable resources. We developed some things we call QPACs, so there's guides for how one would develop curriculum like this. There's sample curriculum. There are sample games that you can download for free. There's a whole video series that show the students and teachers talking about how they do things, how things work. So it's what we found in this, I think you probably all know this, that any individual school is its own thing, because context really matters. So we didn't have a sense that, oh, you have this blueprint that then anyone can take and you just sort of plop down Quest to Learn everywhere. But what we did do is develop a set of design principles, a set of frameworks, prompts, ways that an own school might ask a set of questions, give lots of models and examples of structures and systems that they might bring into play. So I would look at the Institute of Play website. They just redesigned it, so hopefully it's easier to find things. But there's just there's like 8 years of stuff for free that you can download. So I would start there. Yeah.
Yeah, I want to connect those two speeches from, I forgot the name.
it's just Mimi Ito, Katie Salen, no, Benjamin Jürgensen.
Benjamin Jürgensen and Katie. It's under which license are those materials? Because we heard that it should be, we should participate thinking about power and things like this in networks, and these resources, are they free for the community so that the community can think about the codes and the things hide in the games?
Yes, so all the materials are free, so they're all
Creative Commons.
Creative Commons, that's okay. Right. And one other thing that the Institute is doing is that they have a professional, national program in the States, which could scale internationally, called Teacher Quest, and it's for educators. And that's really an open community where educators take the ideas, bring them back to their own school, they develop models, and they share them with that community. So it's really intended to be, Mimi talked about the open network principle, so it's at play there. So anything that's produced there, the idea is we want people to take it up, iterate on it, make modifications, but more importantly, share it back with the larger community so people can learn from each other.
Okay, and if a child on that school, I probably had to miss a part of your talk, if they use so much technology, they produce a lot of data, is that storaged in any way?
Well, it depends on the piece of technology. So when the kids are doing a project in Minecraft, that data is related to the server that they're playing Minecraft on. It's all over the place, the data.
Yeah, just asked because I heard another talk some month ago, which was concerning about the effects on, big data analysts of learning tracks. And if we use digital learning resources, we could use those tracks. And it is dangerous for community and society if it is possible for companies, for example, to look after these tracks if they want to employ somebody. Yeah, I saw you played Minecraft at school and you were not that good at buildings which contain shapes like this, so I don't want you as an architect or something like this. Not looking after what this kid developed.
Yeah, that's a wonderful question indeed, and a very important one, because that shows that the question of who does what in which respect with those technologies has to be thought upon, of course. And this is exactly the thing. Who has, in that sense of Galloway Thacker, so to say, so who defines what may get into a network, who defines how would it work? And you can could just put this upon the level of educational technology also on this question. Is that a new technology of surveillance, or is it something that's more in a logic of enabling? The question is who just does the programming, and we are we are lucky if we have some good people thinking about networks for creativity, and of course we have to be aware for all these data mining stuff and individualization and stuff like this.
I would like to take this up and ask Mimi a question that might be related to that. If we take this concern seriously, could we think of the connected learning model, connected learning approach, without digital means? So could we imagine a set of procedures applying the principles of interest-driven, socially engaged, productive, without any digital means?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the connected learning model is not a technology-specific model at all. And in fact, when we were doing the research and building the model, we looked at a lot of historical examples of connected learning environments that were not digital at all. So, for example, you know, Nicole likes to talk about basketball in Chicago as a connected learning environment because there's this infrastructure of sort of parks and rec centers that is openly networked. Kids can just come in and play basketball. It's multi-generational, and it's tied to opportunity because for kids who might not have other pathways to opportunity, athletics becomes a place where they can connect with mentors. It helps them with their academic success as well. So, you know, athletic programs, at least in the U.S., is probably historically where you find the most kind of robust connected learning environments. Now, we're not focused on that because the infrastructure there is already really robust. But our argument is that, you know, because now there are more digital resources that are sort of openly networked and available, suddenly you have an opportunity space for building connected learning environments and other kinds of areas and specialties compared to previous eras.
Oh, yeah, please.
Now a typical lawyer's question comes. Schools are, especially public schools, are part of systems, and systems are governed. And the governance is the law, because that's the essence of what the negotiation in the society went to. So my question to you as doers in these projects is, what would you think should be changed in the systems law to even better enable these kind of approaches? Are there any core things that would be applicable in Europe and in the US at the same time?
Yeah, so I think, you know, from a kind of policy and governance perspective, we're living in very interesting times because, in a way, like a lot of what, you know, we look at in terms of, if you take a youth-centered view, a lot of their learning has actually already changed and been transformed, but it's largely the commercial sector that has been enabling it. So if you think of Google as like the dominant learning platform of our era, you know, then in many ways this stuff is happening, and it ties back to all the data privacy issues as well, that you have the school policy and governance, but you also have the governance of commercial infrastructures, and those two things have tend and continue to be governed by quite separate sort of imperatives and people. And you know, one of the things that we've been advocating for is, you know, better coordination and sort of development of policies that look across those two sectors. And it's extremely challenging and difficult because, you know, even getting a company like Google to say, look, you're in the business of education, not just like what they do in their education bucket, which is, you know, they do stuff for teachers and schools and they have their apps for education, which is within that box. But their core platform is an educational platform, and changing the conversation so that people understand, you know, learning as something that doesn't just happen within that formal box of education from a policy perspective is incredibly important. So, you know, on the data privacy issue, you know, that these are one of the areas where the rubber hits the road, where there's a whole set of policies that govern how private institutions use consumer data, which is different from how schools govern student data. And when those things start crossing over, it becomes incredibly problematic and challenging because the state and the school system has much more control over students' futures, right? They have more power. And so, you know, there was a very high-profile example of the Gates Foundation funding a student database, which was kind of conceived of as like a open, transparent, kind of built on some of these openly networked principles, but the data was gonna be controlled by the school districts. And then the parents just rebelled and shut the whole thing down. But it's very tricky to get these things to work together. And you know, Katie and I, our Minecraft program, for example, you know, we were originally working as a for-profit and we're governed by, you know, all the student privacy things that assumes that what you're trying to do is advertise to kids and doesn't have any protections for the kinds of things that schools and educational institutions worry about. But it tells us, you know, you're not allowed to do these things that assume we're a company that, you know, advertises to kids. And so all of these policies are completely out of step with, you know, where things need to be if you really want to have a safe, friendly internet that kids can learn on. And there are so many policies that actually hamper and, you know, that tell nonprofits, you can't do nice things for kids because you're evil. And, you know, it's very important, but I don't have any positive and hopeful examples for you, unfortunately, just a lot of struggles.
I'm going to answer in German because that's kind of a German thing. Mimi hat ja schon auf sowas wie Copyright-Fragen beispielsweise, die bei uns in Deutschland auch eine Riesenproblematik sind, ja? Also das Verhältnis von Lobbygruppen und so weiter. Ich würde aber gerne auf einer grundsätzlicheren Ebene antworten, denn Sie spielen ja an auf deliberative Prozesse, die über Werte- und Normorientierungen zu Gesetzgebungsverfahren führen. Das ist auch natürlich haben Sie darin vollkommen recht, nur es ist nicht so, dass, also würde ich vielleicht mal gucken, ob Sie mir zustimmen, dass das Rechtssystem sozusagen ein direkter Outcome von deliberativen Prozessen ist. Das ist komplexer. Es ist, Niklas Luhmann, der Soziologe, sagt, ein eigenes System, es ist ein Subsystem und als solches entwirft es seine Welt. So, und das funktioniert, bitte? Ah ja, es muss sozusagen konstruktivistisch. Es kann nichts anderes verarbeiten, als es selber sozusagen als Verarbeitungsgröße definiert. Zum Beispiel kann Gerechtigkeit im Rechtssystem, das ist schwierig sozusagen, moralischer Begriff. Ne? Wie dem auch sei. Aber der Punkt ist an der Stelle, dadurch kommt eine gewisse Trägheit in so ein System, ganz notwendig, und die tut uns auch in der Regel gut. Also selbst im Hinblick auf, wenn man immer schimpft über das deutsche träge Bildungssystem mit dem Föderalismus und so weiter, da wäre ich sehr vorsichtig, weil das durchaus diese gewisse Trägheit hat Vorteile. Allerdings ist es so, dass in solchen starken Umbrüchen, also in so disruptiven Phasen wie diesen, wir nicht mehr hinterherkommen. Und das Beispiel, wo man sieht, dass sozusagen dann auch die Meinung und die Werte nicht mehr funktionieren, ist das autonom fahrende Auto. Denn hier plötzlich, das kann es erstmal auf Rechtsgrundlagen nicht geben, denn der Verantwortungsaspekt ist vollkommen ungeklärt. Dieses Gesetz, das sozusagen auf dem bürgerlichen Recht und so weiter, wie von Hegel vor 200 Jahren entworfen oder so knapp, was darauf basiert, das basiert auf Subjekten. Jetzt haben wir aber Hybride, Algorithmen und irgendwie Hirne, die irgendwas zusammen entscheiden. Wer ist verantwortlich, wenn was passiert? Und diese Art von Paradigmawechsel, die sehen wir jetzt beim fahrenden Auto besonders. Bei anderen Sachen wären sie aber schon längst da gewesen, zum Beispiel eben Copyright. Das heißt, in diesem Sinne meine ich das immer. Ne? Also das heißt, wenn ich jetzt schimpfe über Ministerien, ich weiß auch, das muss ich vielleicht korrigieren, das sind wirklich gute und kreative Leute, die versuchen, Dinge zu ändern. Aber es gibt eben sozusagen diese Strukturträgheit an dieser Stelle. Und das Problem ist, dass wir die Probleme von morgen mit den Mitteln von gestern zu lösen versuchen, auch rechtlich. Und das muss, glaube ich, anders werden. Anderes Beispiel, Caterham Kensio. Wir geben 10 Milliarden Euro pro Jahr aus in der Bundesrepublik zur Herstellung von Fernsehcontent. Wo ist die Stelle, wo ein neues Gemeingut, nämlich die Algorithmen, die Filter und so weiter, wo ist die Stelle, wo unser aller Interesse in die Erstellung neuer digitaler algorithmischer Allgemeingüter geht? Das gibt es überhaupt gar nicht. Das geht dann mal über Forschungsvergabe oder so. Ja? Traumschiff versus fairer Filteralgorithmus, kann man mal drüber nachdenken. Also das sind solche Probleme.
Das ist ja mal eine Forderung. Traumschiff gegen...
Ja, Sie können gerne Traumschiff gucken, aber...
Ich glaube, die Wahlen gehen immer wieder darum. Nicht so. Nicht wahr? Wer so, ja. Aber anderes Thema. Ja.
Hello. Hi. I find that the world of new technology and new media is really exciting right now for the potential it offers youth to crowdsource their learning and to collaborate in new and exciting ways. And so I wonder what you think are the best ways that we can harness new media, new technology, and the ability to collaborate to tackle really challenging local and global problems. Did I explain myself well? I can read.
To whom are you asking? To all three? To,
well, I was thinking of Miss Ito when I was thinking of the question, but you all seem so qualified to answer it, so I didn't know who to pick.
Yeah, no, I think I share your enthusiasm about, just the ability to, it's kind of what we try to capture in our shared purpose principle that, and what Dewey was, he didn't have the same tools to be able to do these, massively kind of connected, collaborative kinds of experiments, but just this idea that you have the ability to connect school and the wider world in different ways, and not just connect it, but connect it by connecting students to, bigger projects of shared purpose. And so I think, we all of us as educators know that, there's nothing more exciting than when, the learning is embedded in something that is sort of a meaningful contribution, whether that's civic engagement or doing a big project. And, I think that's why, Minecraft is such low-hanging fruit because, there are already server communities. All you have to do is, sort of build a scaffold around that, build challenges. So that's sort of the low-hanging fruit part of it. But there's definitely, bigger models of, networked, competitions, like there's a growing movement around sort of cybersecurity and capture the flag and hacking competitions that are just run fully online. We have a partner network called Youth and Participatory Politics that's been looking at sort of youth civic mobilization and learning around that. So, you'll get these activist projects. Like one of my favorite is the Harry Potter Alliance, which is Harry Potter fans mobilized for social good, and they run these huge campaigns for like fair trade or for inclusion and tolerance on certain issues. But it's all wrapped around this narrative that they're Dumbledore's army and they're going to fight for justice. And because there's something for everybody in this environment, young people have the ability to mobilize networks around things that they feel a genuine passion and sense of belonging for. And I think it's really just about good listening and providing supports. And there's so many of these. Oh, another one I like is the Imagination Foundation does a global cardboard challenge, which was based on a little kid in LA who built a cardboard arcade in his dad's garage, and a filmmaker just happened to come in and played the arcade, was super inspired and made a video that went viral, and now Kane's Arcade, there's educators all over the world on this one day of making where they do their cardboard challenge. And it's just this very heartwarming thing where you can see, you know, the global connections of a very simple activity like that play out in ways that are really, you know, they give kids a sense of connection and broader purpose to that's, you know, connected to their local practices but visible across much wider networks. So those are just a few examples I know.
Yeah, I just want to pick up on one point. So Mimi mentioned the word community a couple times just there when she was talking. And so, and I'll talk about it in a school context. So historically, schools have often tried to do something, often in science, the citizen science example, where they connect the kids to experts, scientific experts, and they actually work on some real problem. It happens in elementary school, middle school, high school. But often that project lasts a week, it may last 2 weeks, it may last a semester, and then that expert goes away. The project ends, and those kids don't have a way to continue to participate. So one of the, you know, the real values of the connectivity today is that you can actually really connect kids to communities that are persistent. And those are communities that they can participate in an ongoing way. And there's a reciprocal relationship between information that they might provide, their participation, and the participation of others in that community. So that's something I would think about just, again, at a school level, is what are the ways in which you're really supporting the young people in maintaining participation in the kind of community that's dealing with, you know, some of the problems that you're talking about. Because when it's just a school assignment, it doesn't go very far, right? And the technology today actually allows for, you know, any number of online communities that are incredibly interesting, that are kid-friendly.
Communities that persist is something that makes also a lot of sense for the relationships between art institutions and schools. I could take one or two short questions. Yeah, please.
Hi. My question would be about the way we construct knowledge with the tools on the internet, basically. I'm very obsessed about the fact that hypertext is the foundation of internet, and it's a way of thinking which is based on association, whereas human beings are thinking through analogies. So how this is going to change the way we think? Because obviously kids, students, everybody, even adults, now we make research only on internet. Barely nobody goes to libraries anymore or goes. So it's really different now.
Any references? Okay, let me get my database because my memory is inside that thing, mainly. So that's, well, I think if I got that question right, we've kind of been thinking about what happens to, well, I have to put it in German, Gegenstände, Lerngegenstände, to subjects. Subject matters, maybe that's the best translation for that. What happens to subject matters, and from my real arts education, for example, we have the issue of museum things. That's one thing. So you have some material stuff, and it has got a presence. So you have that there, like this would be the water bottle from any wall or so, and then it would have kind of a presence itself. And of course, the presence is not only in the material structure of the thing, because it's kind of in between the knowledge and the thing. If I say this is a bottle from any wall, you have knowledge and this kind of stuff. Nowadays, this is changing. The very nature of what is a subject matter is changing through this hybridization of classical media materialities on the one hand and digital augmentation technologies, for example, on the other hand. If you visit the wonderful Berlin Naturkunde Museum, Natural Museum of History, Museum of Natural History, then you see one of the biggest dinosaurs we have in Europe, or so at least they say, I believe them, and the kids don't run to the bones of that thing because they run to the screens that overlay that with an experience of augmented reality. So, and this is what a dinosaur is, and then you can have a look at the bones or so. But it's kind of in between. So things are changing in many respects, of course. And we still don't really know where that leads to, at least me, but we are doing research about that.
So just a few sort of empirical touch points on it. So Pew has been doing a series of surveys around young readers and library use, and what they found is that young people actually read books at higher rates than older folks. So I think it's also really important to keep in perspective that the traditional literacies aren't necessarily going away. So the majority of, and in part it's because a lot of young people are still in school, but it's actually the older generation that reads fewer books than younger generation. So that's sort of one data point. The other data point I think is set of studies that I think is incredibly interesting is what Karen Lunsford has been doing at Stanford, which is about writing practices, reading and writing practices for college students. And they've found that, you know, the volume of reading obviously has gone up tremendously with the advent of digital. Also the volume of writing. Now the nature of writing has changed to be much more sort of social and interactive, that like, there are more sort of social, like even if they're writing long form texts, they're often situated within a social kind of environment. So I think that's probably the biggest shift, is that the production of text knowledge is experienced as a much more social activity than it was with previous generations. Now, when you look at just the quality of writing, that actually hasn't changed in the past 20 years. So she analyzed student writing from 20 years ago across a wide range of schools, and current writing volume has changed. The number of errors actually has not changed. The nature of the errors has changed, but you know, kids actually do understand the difference between a text message and a college essay. So in terms of just like, oh, kids don't know how to write anymore, that is actually not borne out. But I think the social dimensions of young people's interaction with media is, in my mind, the biggest shift. And, you know, we don't really know what the outcome is, you know, of that experiential change, I think.
That's a good point. Ah, yeah, one last question. Do we have? Are we? Yeah.
Thank you. I really enjoyed your talks. They seemed to although you talked about digital, it involved social space and physical space as well. And often it seems those things can be separated, but you all talked about them in ways that made clear the relations between those three, physical, social, and digital. But I would like to know, with your experience coming from digital areas, what you think some, or what your hopes would be for physical design of educational places, perhaps for the future. What could you imagine, or what would you hope to see in actual physical space changing?
Katie?
Well, so I'll just build on Mimi's point around the social. So a lot of, and I'll just go back to school as an example. A lot of schools' spaces are incredibly siloed. They're walled. So it's, I'm not talking about open design necessarily, but some kind of design that would support the social and would support a kind of openly networked idea. So ways in which kids understand that their information can be shared and published, that other people can take up and use. So that, I think that's one thing. So collaboration and peer learning is another one. Again, we just know that the way people use technology is more and more social, and that the learning is really embedded in that relationship between people. So, you know, physical design that really supports, you know, peer-to-peer exchange, peer-to-peer learning, that kind of thing is really important. You know, we saw in the school, I actually didn't really talk much about technology in the school because in a way it's just sort of something that's kind of running under the hood. But we played a lot with differences just in physical structures of technology, so a laptop versus a tablet. And one interesting thing we found with a tablet is kids, it supported peer learning in a much stronger way, physically, because you could physically spin it around, and kids, like a circle, you know, a circle desk, it had a similar kind of thing. So again, envisioning a kind of space that supports that collaborative social kind of learning, I think, would be really important and interesting.
Okay, so I'd like to quote, take Mimi's words, that we are at a point where we don't know where we're heading to, but at the same time, we know a lot about how to create this, create the spaces to share, to start exploring the unknown. I am very thankful for the three of you for your insights and perspectives. And I think we could stay for hours, but we still have a very intense workshop program. So we will stop here. Workshops go on at 4:30, and a warm applause for Mimito, Katie Salen, and Benjamin Iris, and thank you very much.